Please be seated. I don't know exactly when it happened for you, but I'm sure that it did, at least for 50% of us, very conservative estimate. But at some point, and maybe it was when you were in the 11th grade in high school, or maybe it was your first year of college, or in your junior year in college, when you were taking that survey course on American fiction, but at some point in your life, some earnest English teacher asked you to read this book, Ernest Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea. Maybe you remember the tale, maybe you don't, maybe you took one tour, maybe you've taken many tours. I think there is a measure of strategy that the English teacher brings this to the threshold of the teenager or the young adult, and that strategy is not borne out because the art itself wins Hemingway a Pulitzer Prize because the prose is so beautifully constructed. I think the strategy probably orbits around the reality that this is an American classic, a beautiful tale, and it's only about 125 pages long. So if you are in the 11th grade, if you are 16 or 17 years old, the chance of success, the chance that the English teacher might have some success of getting you to read an American classic from the very beginning to the very end is much greater than with maybe Faulkner's work in comparison, right? And those of us who took that tour when we were adolescents remember a tale, and we remember it in a particular way, right? It is a story of an old man, an elderly Cuban, who spends almost the entirety of his life as a fisherman. And when we join this elderly fisherman at the beginning of Hemingway's tale, maybe you remember that he is well into a string of very bad luck. He is experienced both by himself and with the companionship of who, for the most part throughout the tale, a human being that's just called the boy. Those two have experienced bad luck, no fish for 85 days in a row. The string of luck is so bad that the boy's parents forbid him to accompany the elderly fisherman any more days of work. It's not lucrative enough, and the boy needs to bring in some income to support his family. It is on the outside looking in from the perspective of boyhood or girlhood, a tale of an unlucky fisherman who, as we get deeper into the tale itself, becomes even more unlucky. Though there is a hopeful moment as the elderly fisherman hooks a giant fish, as the tale unfolds before us, we know that catastrophe strikes as he finally lands the old fish, the huge fish, tethers him to the skiff, begins to make his way back to Havana, only for the fish to be consumed by circling sharks. You remember the tale, and perhaps you remember the tale from that sort of 11th grade point of view. But your English professor and those who judge what is worthy of a Pulitzer Prize know that there is much more to the tale itself, right? It is not just a story about a horrifically unlucky Cuban fisherman, one who is elderly and weakening under his old age. Rather, It is an existential tome. It is a story or even a myth. And I should say, I use the word myth not to indicate that it is a work of fiction, but I use the word myth so that we know when we're listening to a story like this, a story that has such great power, that it is richer and deeper in meaning than just the tale itself. Something deeper is going on here. And the fact that Hemingway is able to capture the depth of human existence within the context of 125 pages is most assuredly what wins him the Pulitzer Prize. It is a beautiful work of fiction, and it is, in its own creative and lovely way, a story of human existence. The path that Hemingway leads us on is a path that philosophers and gurus and priests and pastors and artists over the course of the existence of humanity, it is the same path of existential understanding, like who are we and who gets to say what life means? And how is it that we human beings discover this reality in that original, attached to origin, that original question, who am I and what does it mean that I am here? When we read it through the lens of the existentialist, we hear a story about a human being who is defined both by his past and by his presence. The title itself says this is an old man, and we learn that his companion, the boy, seeks out a relationship with the old man because the boy has some intuitional sense that the old man has some wisdom to pass on to him, that in fact it is not just the craft of being a fisherman, because the boy could attach himself to more successful fishermen, right? But it is that this old man possesses something that this young man needs. And in this experience of being separated from the boy, the old man goes out on one final hero's adventure. In that moment, this old man carries himself out over the sea, over the unconscious, over the shadow itself, and in a moment of opportunity, finds himself tethered to the unconscious. And the story itself, the struggle that he undergoes, this existential struggle, is one that includes great hope and significant suffering. As the unconscious, the deep, pulls this man all around the sea. It is a glorious tale told in only 125 pages. And if you haven't read it since the 11th grade, I encourage you to take another tour. It is a gorgeous myth that helps us understand the work of midlife and beyond, the work of the second half of life, of integration, integrating the past and the present, integrating the conscious and the unconscious. There are these beautiful moments where the fisherman remembers his life as an adventurous young man, as a sailor across the sea from the bow of the boat, looking at the African shoreline while the lions play on the beach, on the African beaches in the evening as the sun is setting. It's another tale of hope as the boy who has this intuitional sense that there is more to life than just baiting a hook and dropping it into the water, that there's more to learn about life than just that professional success that we need to engage in order to sustain our own lives. And then there are these gorgeous lines of where the old man has experienced such love in his life, love that he's lost when he loses his wife, that he places the picture of his wife face down on the shelf and puts a book on top of it because she is lost. She has died, and with her death, that love is lost. It is a gorgeous tale, and I don't speak about this tale this morning so that you might become animated by a love for American fiction and take another tour, but rather, if you have been around this church Sunday after Sunday, from time to time, you have heard me say that when it comes to gospels, the evangelist John is like the Faulkner of the evangelists, but the evangelist Mark is like the Hemingway. Mark never uses an adjective or an adverb that he doesn't absolutely need to lose. And we are exposed to this beautiful existential passage from Mark's gospel this morning. If you listen to the story, it unfolds with Jesus engaging the people that he spends the most time with. And he asks them this question in two lines. He says, all of those people out there, all of those people that we have touched, all of the people that we have encountered as we have been adventuring across this land, who do they say that I am? Who am I to those people? Jesus asking his disciples, the disciples responding, some of the usual suspects for Israel, right? Some say that you're John the Baptist. Some say that you're Isaiah or another magnificent prophet who has a powerful connection to God. And then he asks the question again, right? He asks the question of those people with whom he is in the closest proximity. He says, oh yeah? Well, who do you say that I am? And Peter responds, the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus responds by hushing him, knowing that the rest of the crowd is not quite ready to hear the depth of what that means, just like Jimmy Bartz in the 11th grade was not quite ready to hear that this is one of the most beautiful existential myths in the history of American fiction, right? These stories that we have, whether they come from Hemingway or whether they come from the evangelist Mark or whether they come from other prophets and sages, these stories are layered in meaning. And when we attach ourselves to them, we can have this tendency to just read them on the surface for what they are. Oh, I get it. A very unlucky Cuban fisherman who at the end of the day faces enormous catastrophe. Catastrophe that is so big that it almost feels exaggerated. These stories that we have from Scripture read the same, right? When we just listen to the story that Mark tells about Jesus interacting with the disciples, we could come up with the conclusion that it seems like Jesus is somewhat like uncharacteristic and somewhat unlovingly is giving his disciples a pop quiz. Like, okay, everybody, take out a pencil and a piece of paper and put it on your desk. I want to see if you have been doing your homework. Who do you say that I am? Well, some say John the Baptist, and some say Isaiah. I think you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. That's right, Peter. A plus for you. All the rest of you flunkies didn't really get it. By the way, the circumstances around which you are ultimately going to be tested upon are much more significant. And the life that I'm delivering you is one that is hard and cruel. But that, in fact, is not at all the story. Jesus is trying to lead us into an understanding about how humanity is defined and how we understand ourselves. He's taking us all the way back to the first and second stories of the Jewish Christian scriptures themselves, back to those Genesis creation myths, where the work of God in the world is, in an exaggerated way, creative and loving. It's not just about these beats that we have in creation, but it is about what the vision for creation itself is. And that vision, at its very core, is interdependence. Now, that can come against, somewhat frustratingly so, to our Western-minded sense of independence. But that is the tale itself, the tension between interdependence and independence. We could read it like the 11th grader reads it, where it's a story about humanity breaking the rules and just doing what we want. But that is not the point. That's not the point of these stories, and it's not the point of rules, right? The serpent is the craftiest creature in the garden. The serpent doesn't come forward and say, "Hey, guys, let's be evil. Let's break the rules." The suggestion that the serpent makes to humanity is like, did God really say that you can't do this? I think it's because God thinks that you can be like, the lesson there that the serpent is seeking to deliver is like, hey, humanity, you've got this. You've got it. You don't need God. You don't need each other. You can do it on your own. But the stories that we get from Scripture, the stories beneath the story, and the story that Hemingway himself is trying to deliver us, rather, is that we are who we are because of the relationships that we have. We are who we are. We are defined by the connections that we have. We are who we are because we are the shelter of each other. Jesus, after he rebukes Peter, begins to tell the disciples, begins to tell humanity what humanity's real role is. If you want to become one of my followers, you take up your cross and follow me. You, if you want to be really human, if you want to be the person that God has made you to be, you will spend out your days in service to others. That will be the thing that defines your identity. And oh, by the way, that reality is so counter to the culture that you will experience suffering in that reality. The more that you seek to embody the beautiful life that God has made you for and the life that you were intended to leave, the higher the tension becomes. as the old man, beyond the first day, into the second day, and into the third day, is dragged around the surface of the unconscious or the shadow, the old man suffers, right? I don't know why, I just know it to be true. But nevertheless, the beauty of interdependent connection far exceeds the suffering that we experience. The boy himself remains intimately tied to the old man after suffering the disappointment of the loss of the fish, right? And Jesus himself reemerges, not as some magic trick to show you that he was the Son of God, but reemerges post-death and resurrection to remind us who we are. If you were around on Sunday night for campfire, and I know that some of you were, over at The Verge, Travis interviewed Merrill Wade, our Chapel of the Transfiguration chaplain, and me, talking about some of the creative ministries that Merrill and I have engaged in over the course of our professional life or over the course of our ordained priesthood. And it was a wonderful evening, and it was enlightening. It was touching for me to have the opportunity to talk a little bit about the work that I did before I arrived at St. John's, but honestly, to talk more about the work that I do on myself, the work that perhaps you benefit from, like secondarily, but the attention that I give to my own heart. And Robert Ayers asked this question when we were in the Q&A, which was such a beautiful moment for me. He said, well, when you pray, he asked this to both Merrill and me, when you pray, not like, what do you say, but what do you hear? Like, what do you hear from God when you are praying and asking and listening? And my mind immediately went to one thing, and it's a beautiful moment, and I mean to say this humbly, so just like stay with me for a minute here. There is a guy named Eugene Peterson. Eugene Peterson is a New Testament scholar and a pastor. He lived up in Livingston, Montana until he died a few years ago. And Eugene Peterson is not perfect, but he is a brilliant disciple. Like, he sought for the entirety of his life to devote himself to love who we know to be God. And in this work, he translated both the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, and the New Testament, the Christian Scriptures, into like common parlance. And there's this episode that he translated that is so meaningful to me. And if I were ever to get ink, more ink, I have a regrettable orange longhorn from my college days on one of my hips. Yeah, I know, I know. I was a young man. I was a boy. If I were ever to get more ink, this is what I would get. He translates this moment that he has, that this moment from the scriptures where John is baptizing Jesus in the Jordan River. Do you remember in the traditional language says, this is my son in whom I am well pleased. And Peterson's words are, and I've told these to you before, and I've told them to you before because they mean so much to me. He says, this is my child, chosen and marked by my love, the delight of my life. And when Robert asked that question, I was like, that's what I hear. That's what I hear when I pray. But to be sure, that's what I hear, not because I'm lucky or because I'm good, but that's what I hear because I have been metaphorically dragged around the surface of the unconscious for years and years of my life because I, like you, have heard the opposite for a long time. And I, like you, am a person, a quester, someone who is hungry for a different, more meaningful reality. And I am going to do the work that it takes to get to that cornerstone, to that original understanding of who we were made to be. Church. This is the work of faith. And to be clear, this is not the milky side of the work. This is the meaty side of the work. And so we don't talk about it a lot on Sunday morning, right? Because if there are levels 1 through 10, then the sermon needs to be like level 4 and down. Because, like, we need a good word, right? So I have a sense that there is a good chance that I am not connecting with all of you this morning. But if I am connecting with one of you, and one of you is beginning to change what you hear about you, if one of you has heard in the past or even in the present that, like, you're good but not great, you're okay, you're not so great, you're not someone we're so proud of, like, you're really not all that, if that is the tape that you hear, if there is one of you in this room who is beginning to change her mind and her heart, who is beginning to sniff out just a whiff or just a taste that there is a different reality at work, and it has always been at work in your life. If it feels like both foreign but strangely familiar, if when I say you are a child chosen and marked by God's love, the delight of God's life, if there is a millimeter of you that has some sense that it might be true, then I am asking you, then I am begging you to lean toward it, to point your ship in that direction. Amen.